WRNI Providence, I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tonight we travel the road of the bluesman, the wanderer, the men and women uprooted first from their ancestral home in Africa, only to set out again in the Jim Crow south of the early 20th century. They went in search of work on the lawless levee camps and steamboats, where the fertile land of the Mississippi Delta was being remade by a generation of axemen and mule skinners. They walked the rows of shanties, hoping to be taken in. Throughout the 1930s and 40s, John A. and Alan Lomax followed the dirt roads and rode the rails across forests and plantations to record the sound of America in transition. In thousands of hours of music and conversation, they captured a changing world. From port swing singers to chain gang rhythms, the Lomax archive tells the story of African Americans in the land of the blues. Anna Lomax, the third generation of a folklorist family, was there for some of these recordings. She remembers the warm eyes of Big Bill Brunsey and being bounced on Leadbelly's knee. Tonight on Point, travelling to the source of America's deep blues with the Alan Lomax Archive and Anna Lomax. And joining me now from New York City is Anna Lomax, daughter of Alan Lomax. She's directing the series of recordings being released on Rounder Records. Good evening and welcome to you, Anna.
Hi.
And also from New York, Don Fleming, director of licensing for the Alan Lomax Archive. Good evening, Don.
Hello to you.
Anna Lomax, it's been said of your father, Alan, that he captured the human spirit in song. When did he begin? How did he begin that journey?
Well, I guess he began for real when he was about 17 years old. He went with his father. They set out from Dallas to start collecting with a wire disc recording machine borrowed from the Library of Congress.
I mean, it was said that he started, or rather John A. Lomax anyway, started transcribing cowboy songs as a child and was discouraged by a professor at the University of Texas. Is that so?
Well, that's the story. He started writing down the cowboy songs that the cowboys were still riding the last rides of the Chisholm Trail when he was a boy in Meridian, Texas. And the branch of the Chisholm Trail went by his farmhouse. And he just fell in love with this. And later on, when he went to the university, which was when he was quite well along, he didn't get to go right away. He showed his collection to one of his teachers, and the professor said, "Well, Lomax, I'm terribly sorry, but this is just, I just hate to tell you this, but it's just a pile of trash. You just have to get rid of it." And he was just heartbroken. He went out in the back of a building and burned it all up.
How did the folklorists see themselves? What drove them to get out on the road and make these recordings?
I guess at that time, I think that many of them started to realize that these songs and stories of the people represented the real spirit of their nations and wherever they might have been from. I think that that was part of the impetus, that they were trying to find the roots of a kind of true nationhood, as it were. And for my grandfather, he didn't really give up then. He went on to do more, and later he got a fellowship to go to Harvard, and he talked to one of his professors there, who was George Lyman Kittredge, who was one of the great English literature people of that era. There he was, what he was trying to do was recognized and encouraged, and Kittredge said, "You know, Lomax, you better go back to Texas and do more of this. This is really, you know, this is what American literature really is." And so he went on to found the Texas Folklore Society with other fellow folklorists.
It was also very driven by the technology of the time, because this was the first time you could record music. And I think, you know, a lot of the people who had been studying, and like John A. was transcribing cowboy songs, suddenly realized, well, I can record these and other people can actually hear all the nuances in it. And what else happened is that this oral tradition of passing down music that had gone on for all of history up until then suddenly changed, because when technology came in and the records began to be produced, then, you know, I think Alan especially saw that this old way was being lost, and so he started to seek out and spent really his whole life trying to find the isolated areas where you could still find work songs and all the different types of songs that he knew had been passed down for centuries, you know.
Let's just hear an example of one of those early recordings. This is a field holler recorded at the State Penitentiary in Richmond, Virginia in 1936, performed by Rollie Lee Johnson.
Oh, I think I heard the wild moan. Line tagger, ooh. Line tagger, ooh. Hello there. Yeah, you walk along here. Oh, the big ball leader, he done gone on down. Line tagger, ooh. Line tagger, ooh. Hello there. Yeah, Ken, go along a little bit, yeah. Oh, she's not my woman, just from my home. I give her my money just to help her along. I got mad to be a lover and a loaded line. Gonna knock a man's bottom till the ghost don't fly. Oh, baby. Yeah, yeah, must walk along with this. Oh, she said my dinner, didn't know my name.
Now, Anna Lomax, your father described the moan, the Levee Camp Holler. What were the laborers doing when they were singing that?
Oftentimes they were driving their mules with huge loads of dirt that they were hauling up from the bottomlands onto the levee to build a levee. And they were experts at that. I mean, they were very good at working with these animals and
It was a very hard life, wasn't it? And these recordings, the music, conveys some of the sense of that hardness.
Oh, yeah, sure. If you go down to the Delta area and you go out into the rural places, you know, you can still find people who as children saw the levees being built and being maintained and whose parents had worked on them and so on. And you can still get the feeling of that whole life if you really go and talk to people. I went down there last year to Arkansas to talk to a couple of people that Alan recorded back in 59. And it was quite an experience because it's so different from Memphis and, you know, the urban centers. Like, I mean, Memphis is kind of like the New South, and furthermore, you know, the blues area, the Beale Street, has been kind of, in a way, Disney-fied, you know, version of what it had been in its real time of musical splendor. And when you go out of that environment and you get out into the country and you go to the towns that are still there and they're still producing cotton on a massive scale, these huge farms, and, you know, it's just mechanized, but people are still working on them for, you know, low wages and so on. You go to these towns and you really get a sense of what it must have been like.
Okay, we're going to hear now pieces from three versions of the same song recorded in different states at different times. These songs were carried by laborers and traveling minstrels across the South, and they're all on separate compilations in the Deep River of Song series.
Oh, weave on, where you get your grand long bill. I got it from Texas, I got it from the Western Hills. I got it from Texas, I got it from the West on the hill.
Oh, we've been here, he built his old and gone. Oh, we've been here, he done built his old and gone. You can tell by that boll weevil won't be along.
First time I seen the boll weevil, he's sitting on the square. Next time I see him, he had his family there. Boll weevil, yeah, boll weevil everywhere. They done ate up all the cotton and corn, all but the new ground square. Well, the farmer asked him much on the first of meat and meal. Ain't nothing done, old man, for weevils in your field. Hey, for weevils, where is your native home? Way down in the bottom, among the cotton and corn.
Don, why that image of the boll weevil?
Well, I think it's a bit of a lonely image, you know, and this has been discussed too, that, you know, the blues, the feeling of the blues came, and you brought this up about the levees, like, you know, that kind of work song on the levee conveyed the feeling of the person, and those kind of songs, especially boll weevil, just tells sort of like a personal loneliness, you know. I think that more than anything was the way that the work songs influenced what became really what we know as the blues, in that, you know, around the levee camps, for example, the juke joints would pop up, especially like the ones in Arkansas that Anna was talking about. This is when it went from what was really a traditional cultural, you know, African thing of like singing while you work to, and in the early, in like the 20s, the teens in the 20s, most people played banjos and fiddles, but suddenly the guitar became like the primary instrument. And it was about that time that people, and another thing was in the more traditional African context, that people sang together a lot. But in America then, people became more isolated, and a man with a guitar could go sing anywhere. And that really, it was that work song tradition, those kind of themes that developed into what became the blues.
Okay, well,
and it appealed to so many people because of the theme of loneliness, of alienation, of mobility, of people who were at the mercy of change that was beyond their control, in a sense. Because it wasn't just simple poverty that was the problem. It was, you know, the sense of being uprooted and having to always find a new home, like the boll weevil.
Okay, well, go out listening to Blind Willie McTell singing Just As Well, Get Ready, You Gotta Die, recorded by John A. Lomax in Atlanta, Georgia, in November 1940. This recording brings the oral tradition to life as Blind Willie remembers the music his parents used to sing while getting ready to work in the fields.
I will demonstrate how my mother and father used to wonder about their work when they used to sing those old-fashioned hymns. Cooking breakfast, trying to get ready to go to the field, trying to make some of that old country money.
Stay with us, Anna Lomax and Don Fleming, while we take a break. We're talking tonight about the audio portrait of the American South, created by folklorists John A. and Alan Lomax.
Just well to get ready, you got to die. It may be tomorrow. Can't tell the minute nor the hour. Just while to get ready, you got to die. You got to die. Just while to live.
Carolina.
This is On Point. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the birth of the blues in America as captured by Alan Lomax. Joining us from the Alan Lomax Archive is Don Fleming and Anna Lomax, daughter of Alan and granddaughter of John Lomax. The archive has reissued newly remastered recordings of hundreds of songs. In the background is Goodnight Irene by Huddy Ledbetter, better known as Lead Belly. This was recorded by John A. and Alan Lomax at the Louisiana State Penitentiary in Angola, Louisiana, on July the 1st, 1934.
Good night, Irene. Good night, Irene. I guess you in my dream.
Now, Anna Lomax, the legend of Lead Belly is that he was freed from Angola prison, is often linked with this song. Is that a true story?
Well, no, actually. He had been freed from the Texas penitentiary because of his singing, but he was actually, technically speaking, freed for good time. Both he and John A. liked that legend. I mean, it appealed to people very much, and it appealed, I think, to Lead Belly himself because, you know, it was a tribute to his own musical powers in a way. And actually, he had asked John Lomax to bring a copy of a song to the governor of Louisiana, which John Lomax did. He dropped it off there, but that wasn't the actual reason for his
They assumed that's why he was released, but and they both believed that for quite a while, and that's where the story started. And then later on, they found out that Lead Belly's parole had just come up anyway.
Yeah, the governor wrote to John A. and told him what had really happened.
And Anna, do you remember being bounced on Lead Belly's knee as a child?
I really do. I remember going to their house with my parents when they were living in Manhattan in an apartment. And then there was a nice party there with some good close friends. And I remember it very vividly, and I also remember going to their house in Brooklyn on numerous occasions, both when I was around that age and when I came back from Europe when I was a teenager. They had a lovely brownstone in Brooklyn, the family did, and it's been a long relationship.
And Don, Goodnight Irene has certainly endured as a song, later released by the Weavers, Bing Crosby, Jimi Hendrix, Gene Autry. That's quite a selection of artists.
Yes, it is. I mean, that song has inspired many people, and, it still seems to have an influence today. It's we're releasing a new record called Popular Songbook, which is songs that have been, covered by people, everything from Gallus Pole, which Led Zeppelin did a version of, and Goodnight Irene finishes off the record for obvious reasons, because it has such staying power.
And Anna Lomax, work camps, prison songs, very much a feature of that time. Prison was always very close for a black man at that period.
Apparently, yes. It was a way of getting free labor, essentially, for the state and also for farmers, because they would contract out the labor to different private individuals for their farms. And I must say, horrible. It was like a police state, actually. In fact, it was kind of a slow holocaust. And my father recognized that. He said that a long time ago, that it was a form of fascism. It was going on.
And Don Fleming, a black man without a job walking from county to county in the South at that time, could be imprisoned for vagrancy.
Oh, absolutely. Those were very, very hard times. And I think that's one of the things that's interesting about, the record Blues in the Mississippi Night that Alan did with Big Bill and Memphis Slim and Sonny Boy, is that he got them to talk about that. He got them to express their actual, they lived through that. Big Bill worked on those levees and building the roads for the levees. And it was the first time, really, that anyone had recorded people expressing these things. At the time, and Alan brings this out a lot, is that the white Southerners just liked the status quo, you know, and the blacks didn't know how to fight it then and just really didn't have the means to express it. And they expressed it through blues songs, but only usually by hiding what the lyrics were really about and talking about a woman when they were really talking about the boss man. So, yeah, it was a very dangerous time. And even with Blues in the Mississippi Night, they recorded it in 47, and no one wanted to put it out because it was so inflammatory. And then finally, United Artists put it out in 1959 for the first time. And even then, they didn't use the names of the men on there because they were afraid for the repercussions for their families.
And in fact, in his notes for the session in which he recorded Big Bill Bronzy, Memphis Slim, and Sonny Boy Williamson, Alan Lomax called it the story of the birth of blues from the mouths of three great bluesmen. Alan Lomax, tell us how your father managed to invoke a very informal sense, a sense of not actually being in that New York recording studio, but of being on a late Mississippi evening.
Well, I was a very tiny child at the time. They stayed at our house, and when they had come up for a town hall concert, and after the concert, they went to the studio with my father, Decca Records, to talk and play. He's told me about it in great detail. I loved that record when it came out. I played it all the time. I sort of know it by heart. I know the voices of those men by heart, and I met both Bill Brunzi and Memphis Slim several times. But he said, basically, he set the, as he says in his notes, he set the microphone down and asked them if they would talk about their experiences and what the blues really meant to them.
Well, let's just hear a sample of that conversation. In this segment, Big Bill Brunzi is talking about prison life with Memphis Slim.
I've been around where they have prisoners, and they have them chained together, and some chain gangs, they just have chains with a big ball hung to their legs. And I've heard of chain gangs was why they put a chain or rope or something on a guy and put a stake down and tie him to a stake. They let him work till he get out to the length of that rope or that chain or whatever they have to him. Then they pull that stake up and put him to another stake. Then they let him work going around like that, see?
If you give him 100 years or 50 years or 75 years, well, after he was there a certain amount of time and became used to it, they would make a guard out of him.
Yeah, what they call a trustee or something.
Yeah, they'd make a trustee out of him and give him a gun.
Down there, they whoop them down there. They whoop the prisoners down there, but here they don't.
Yeah, well, we still refer...
Cat of nine tails.
We're still referring to the blues, so
well, that's,
that gives
that's
you the blues.
Yeah, that's
the blues
right
down
on.
South is
that's
where
right.
The blues came from.
But
so
what,
that's what
the point, those fellas that they got down there on them chain gangs, with big balls hanging on their legs, can't go anyplace. Those fellas have the blues, too.
Ain't got no mama. Ain't got no, I ain't got no. Lord, I ain't got no at the mother's home.
Now, I know there's an extraordinary record in that recording of the camaraderie and openness between the three musicians. Did your father know what he had when he'd finished?
No, I think he did. I mean, he was very, very experienced in 1947. He'd been working for, you know, nearly 14 or 15 years intensively recording and producing and thinking about the material. But I want to say this, you know, that recording is remarkable because when you hear it, he had not edited out any questions that he had. This was a real conversation between these three men. They forgot he was there. They simply started to talk and to feel and to remember and to sing about what happened. And the fact that they could do it the way they did it in a way was so much, in a way, so much humor and laughter and wit and feeling is a testimony to also the strength of the culture that they came out of, as well as its hardships, you know, because they had so many wonderful things to say, and the way that they said them were so beautiful. And they had, you know, everything called up a song or a tune. You can hear it for yourselves. But it was not a contrived situation, except that he just you know, in that he brought them together and asked them to talk, and they did.
So spontaneity there with the musicians. But, Don, how did Alan go about getting recordings in prisons? Did he have to get permission? Was he able to credit the people he spoke to?
No, absolutely. He did have to get permissions, and it was a difficult thing to do. And even with his letters of intent from the Library of Congress, he met with a lot of resistance. And, you know, it was only, I think, through doing it, and he did it first with his father, and I think, you know, after they had done it a few times, it became somewhat easier. But, yeah, it was a very unusual thing, and people were not used to that. And he speaks a lot about how it was difficult for the prisoners to talk openly to him because in those circumstances they were usually being watched very closely. And he wasn't able to get this kind of conversation out of people. And I think that's why this particular recording was so, he knew how important it was in that these men were able to just open up and talk freely.
Let's just hear more examples of prison songs collected in Mississippi and Texas.
Be my woman, girl, I
be your
cold December day.
Get out of here.
It was on one cold December day.
Get out of here.
When I first come on the bed.
Get out of here.
When I first come on the bed.
Well, it's mama, mama. Oh, Lord, you don't know. Well, it's mama, mama. Mama, you don't know.
It was a montage of work camp and prison songs recorded by Alan Lomax, beginning with CB and 10 prisoners with axes from the Parchman Farm Penitentiary in Mississippi, 1947. The others were recorded in Texas in the 1930s at Huntsville State Penitentiary and Central State Farm. And Anna, we can see in those recordings something of the evolution of the blues, the rhythm there of people working together. Now, how did that evolve from the plantations through there into rhythm and blues?
You know, I really think that's a question that's better left to a musicological expert on the subject, but I wanted to say one thing. You know, these songs have a lot of relevance to the present. When we put together the two prison song albums in the Rounder series called Prison Songs, which were really re-releases of an older, really wonderful album that Alan did, of this material from Parchman Penitentiary, Mississippi, I played it for some young men, young and middle-aged guys who had been served a lot of time in the state prison in New York City, who a friend of mine was working with as a social worker, and they were... I didn't make too much explanation. They were very, very moved by it, and they felt that it was extremely relevant to them. And one of the things that all of them said, remarkably, was that, you know, this music was invented by these people. It was more powerful than religious music or spirituals because it came right out of their hearts and souls, and it was invented by them, and it was their courage in confronting this terrible situation that they were in, which is true. And it's, you know, really relevant to this period where we're in now, where our prison system is expanding by the day and it's becoming privatized, and they're, most of the people in the prisons are minorities. And it's, you know, really something that we ought to be thinking about. Maybe this should be a little bit of a reminder.
Don Fleming, we're hearing there from Anna the way in which these songs and the sentiments resonate through the century. But in your mind, can you see the connection between spirituals and rhythm and blues?
Well, again, yeah, I do believe that these type of songs, these work songs, were a direct link to what became blues, and they were in, a lot of them were the same kind of patterns, and sometimes they were those songs just with a guitar added instead of men with an axe. It really, again, became more of a solitary thing to do the blues, and that's when people started writing songs that were new and then became commercial, and other people started covering them. So it just grew from there, really. But I think that in those work songs, you really are right at the roots of the blues.
But something that started as quite mournful eventually transformed into something a little bit more joyous, didn't it?
Well, absolutely. And also, I mean, there's the argument that most of popular music, American and or English, you know, popular music, is really based on a blues format. And I think that's very true. And so it's really gone way beyond rhythm and blues and soul. It's been very influential on all popular music.
And the blues is a form of that, you know, it's a kind of a song of commentary and witticisms, and it's part of a big tradition that comes out of Africa and the West Indies, and it, you know, the whole Mediterranean world for that matter has songs of that kind. You know, there's a tremendous amount of improvisation, and it's a conversation with the audience. It's a conversation between the singer and his instrument as well, where the instrument is playing the role of another voice, which is responding to the human voice, and so on. So, I mean, that is part of a bigger kind of African style, as it were.
Let's just hear more from Blues in the Mississippi Night Collection. Let's hear Memphis Slim talking about the blues.
The blues and our, to my idea now, the blues and our, the spiritual is somewhat on the same order. I mean, if you have troubles, if you have trouble, you go to church and you sing, you feel happy.
That's right.
And, I mean, you get a little consolation there.
That's right.
Well, it's the same way the blues. I mean, the blues.
Stay with us, Anna Lomax and Don Fleming, while we take a break. We're talking tonight about the audio portrait of the American South created by folklorists John A. and Alan Lomax. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Support.
I remember when I was a little boy, laid it on my mother's knee.
This is On Point. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the African-American experience in the post-Reconstruction South as told through the blues. We're talking with Don Fleming, Director of Licensing for the Alan Lomax Archive, and with Anna Lomax. She's Alan Lomax's daughter and director of the archive, and a series of new recordings, including Blues in the Mississippi Night, Popular Songbook, and the Deep River of Song Collection. We're listening to Stacker Lee, performed by Big Bill Brinsey, Memphis Slim, and Sonny Boy Williamson at an informal session in New York City in 1947. The song, about a ruthlessly cruel riverboat man, has been recorded under a number of titles.
Let it drop, poor Billy Lyon. to be the bad fellow called old Stagger-Lee.
Don Fleming, tell us about the tradition of Stagger-Lee.
Well, Stagger-Lee is one of those songs which, you know, was covered by many people and fits that pattern of the type of songs that Alan sought out that had been passed down orally. And so what happens is, as you go to each different singer in every different town, people put their own spin on it. It's what I guess Pete Seeger likes to call the folk process, which is you take the basic song and you turn it into your own, and you do that by telling your own story. And Stagger-Lee is one of the great ones that you can cite all these examples of. And that's one of the really fun things about listening to the stuff that Alan recorded, is that he would seek out these type of songs that told a story of people's lives in different times and different places.
And a very violent and cruel world.
Oh, absolutely. Well, in the case of the Delta, South Delta life, absolutely.
Anna Lomax, a lot of these blues songs talk about love, talk about women, but what about the women who were left behind by the men? What is known about them?
Well, I think there's a good deal of, you know, good oral history that in which they tell about their lives. And one thing that comes right to my mind at the moment is my father recorded, Alan recorded the story of Vera Ward Hall, who was an Alabama woman, and one of, he said, maybe the best singer that he ever recorded in his whole career, from Livingston, Alabama. And he also Bessie Jones from Brunswick, Georgia, from the St. Simon's Island, I should say, Georgia, gave him 50 hours of biography, of her biography, in the early 60s. And there are some tremendous documents like this. They had a very, very, they had to be incredibly strong. They had to do a huge amount of work, physical labor, plowing and planting and bringing up the children by themselves. And oftentimes they were alone there with a whole bunch of children.
Okay, well, let's listen to One Woman Left Behind, Vera Hall, followed by Big Bill Brunsey and Memphis Slim with another glimpse at why a man sings the blues.
Another man done gone. 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 He's from the county farm. 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 I didn't know his name.
But the main thing about it, I've seen this happen too in the South, that one boy down there, he was a white guy, was liking the same girl that this colored boy was liking. And he told this colored boy not to marry because he wanted it for himself. And the boy told him that he loved her and he was going to marry. He said, well, you can't get no license here. So the boy run off, him and the girl, and went off to another town, and they got married. And they come back there, and the man asked him, was he really married to her? He said, yes. So the girl figured if she showed him the license, he would leave her go. So she showed him the license, then they went up there and got him and killed him. And then come back and got her, and she was in family way, was expecting a baby, and they killed her. And then they went and killed his daddy, and they killed his mother. And then one of his brothers, he went out to fight to try to protect him, and they killed him. So they killed 12 in that one family. If you got a family, they got a girl in the family that they like, you just well let him have her. Because when they see a Negro woman they like, they're going to have her if they want her.
Another man done gone. Another man done gone. Another man done gone. Another man done gone.
Thank you very much indeed for being with us, Anna Lomax, daughter of Alan Lomax. She's directing the series of recordings being released on Rounder Records. And also many thanks to you, Don Fleming, director of licensing for the Alan Lomax Archive. Thank you both.
Thank you for having us.
And we'll leave you listening to Black, Brown and White Blues, performed by Big Bill Brunsey, Sonny Boy Williamson and Memphis Slim from Blues in the Mississippi Nights CD, a new release from the Alan Lomax Archive. I'm Julian Marshall. This is On Point.
This little song that I'm singing about, brother, you know it's true. Now if you black and got to work for a living, this is what they will say to you. They say, if you's white, she's all right. If you's brown, stick around. And as you black, go, brother. Get back, get back, get back. I was in a place one night. They was all having fun. They was all buying beer and wine, but they would not sell me none. They said, if you's white, you'd be all right. As you brown, stick around. As you black, well, brother, get back.
In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
The most important thing when you run a state is leadership. The qualifications we have seen. Governor Gray Davis has campaigned and has said, this is experience that you cannot buy. Well, look where he has gotten us.
To my fellow Californians, I say one thing. I'm as fed up about modern campaigns as you are.
I will continue, with my wife's support, to fund the effort to recall Gray Davis. And when it's over, we will return to Congress.
For me to be heard, I can no longer be doing the show. There has to be separation between the show and my entrance into politics in the elective arena. And that separation obviously has not taken place, and certainly would not take place in time for this election.
I serve at the pleasure of the president, and this is all August speculation with no basis in fact, and no basis for the story to begin with, and we're doing our jobs together.
I'm certain there will be a few for whom this will be so troublesome that they cannot stay, but I will be doing everything that I can, and I believe the entire Episcopal Church will do everything it can to work with these folks and to find a way for us to live together.
Apparently the car was driven to the hotel entrance and was about to be parked somewhere there when a security guard approached the car and the people inside the car, possibly two people, one driver and another passenger, exploded the bomb.
Jordan condemns in the strongest terms the terrorist act that took place today in the Jordanian embassy in Baghdad.
There's been a proposal that has been made by Bishop O'Malley. It's concrete, it's substantive. It's really the first discussion that is we really are going to have about settlement that's concrete.
And there's a week. Arnold Schwarzenegger and Arianna Huffington declare themselves candidates for governor in California's recall election, but recall bankroller Daryl Issa says he will not seek Gray Davis's job. Television host Jerry Springer ends his candidacy for the U.S. Senate. Secretary of State Colin Powell denies a Washington Post report that he'll step down if President Bush is re-elected. Gene Robinson is approved as the Episcopal Church's first gay bishop. A terrorist bombing at a Jakarta hotel kills 10 and injures more than 100. A car bomb at the Jordanian embassy in Baghdad kills 19. And the Roman Catholic Archdiocese of Boston offers $55 million to settle more than 500 clergy sex abuse lawsuits. Jack Beattie, what stands out for you?
This car bomb, this is a very significant escalation of the troubles in Iraq. Before the war, people predicted that whether or not there were terrorists in Iraq then, that is before we invaded, there sure would be after. And this is bearing that out. And we just don't know where this will go or in fact, who did this. but it's striking. It's the first time that civilians, Iraqi and other civilians, have been the target of terrorism there. And, of course, it was a week when four Americans died in Iraq. Their names are Zeferino Kalunga, 20, of Belleville, Texas, Brian Hellerman, 35, of Freeport, Minnesota, Ferraro Letafuga of Pago Pago, American Samoa, and David Lloyd, 44, of Jackson, Tennessee. And while they were on the front lines of democracy, democracy in California was sort of going, running amok. We have this this spectacle of the recall, a recall based upon no perfidy on the part of the governor, simply a budget deficit that ballooned out of control. It would be tantamount, really, to a recall of President Bush. He faces a deficit, too, and for the same reasons Gray Davis did, overspending and certainly the effects of a recession.
Democracy running amok, you say, in California, Jack.
Well, yes. I mean, the recall was something started by turn-of-the-century progressives to reclaim politics from the corrupt Eastern bosses. And the idea was, well, we'll just let the people speak and get around their corrupt representatives. It hasn't worked that way in California. It's been a tool of millionaires and obsessives, really, to change politics to their liking. This initiative began with a Republican millionaire congressman. And, you know, let's put that in context. This is part, we had a caller say to us earlier this week, this is part of almost a campaign by the sort of ultra wing of the Republican Party to basically say elections of Democrats are not legitimate. I think that was an excellent point. It was certainly the case with Bill Clinton. His election, even in 92, was not taken as legitimate, and he was impeached in his second term over, what, lying about sex. And, of course, in Florida, we actually had the spectacle of bully boys hired by a Republican congressman going to intimidate people counting ballots in Miami. So
conservative gains then in California, but the liberals prevail in the Episcopal Church.
Yes, and I think very significantly, this is the kind of thing that's going to change, you know, that'll matter. I mean, symbolic things like that matter. And to have that kind of leadership and to just have this man doing his job, modeling his own relationship with his partner and showing people it's just the same as, men and women. People love each other. People feel attached. People sacrifice for each other.
Jack Beattie, On Point News Analyst, many thanks.
Thanks to you, and it's been a pleasure working with you.
On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Amada, Chris O'Connor, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Julie Jopp and Sarah Cook. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Julian Marshall. This is On Point.
Support for this program comes from Sophos Antivirus, protecting corporate IT networks.